Nicholas chose the best vantage point below this barrier and glassed both slopes of the valley ahead of them. The terrain was as he had remembered it. They were approaching the foot of the escarpment wall, and the ground was becoming more rugged and severe, like the swell of the open ocean sensing the land and rising up in alarm before breaking in confusion upon the shore. The trail followed the river closely. The cliffs hung over the narrow aisle of ground that made up the bank, sculpted by wind and weather into strange, menacing shapes, like the battlements of a wicked witch's castle in an old Disney cartoon. At one point, a buttress of red sandstone overhung the trail, forcing the river to detour around it, and the trail was reduced so much that it would be difficult for a laden mule to negotiate without being pushed off the bank into the river. Nicholas studied the bottom of the valley carefully through the lens. He could pick out nothing that seemed suspicious or untoward, so he raised his head and swept the cliffs and their tops. At that moment, Ali's voice came up from the valley below, echoing along the slope as he shouted, "Hurry, Effendi! The mules are ready to go on!" Nicholas waved down to him, but then lifted the binoculars for one more sweep of the ground ahead. A wink of bright light caught his eye, a brief ephemeral stab of brilliance like the signal of a heliograph. He switched his whole attention to the spot on the cliff from which it had emanated. "What is it? What have you seen?" Rayan demanded. I'm not sure. Probably nothing," he replied, without lowering the binoculars. It may have been a reflection from a polished metal surface, or from the lens of another pair of binoculars, or from the barrel of a sniper's rifle, he thought. On the other hand, a chip of mica or a pebble of rock crystal could reflect sunlight the same way, and even some of the aloes and other succulent plants have shiny leaves. He watched the spot carefully for a few more minutes, and then Ali's voice floated up to them again. "Hurry, Effendi! The mule drivers will not wait!" He stood up. "All right. Nothing. Let's go." He took Royan's arm to help her over the rough footing, and they started down. At that moment he heard the rattle of stones from further up the slope, and he stopped her and held her arm to keep her quiet. They waited, watching the skyline. Abruptly, a pair of long, curling horns appeared over the crest, and under them the head of an old kudu bull, his trumpet-shaped ears pricked forward and the fringe of his dewlap blowing in the hot, light breeze. He stopped on the edge of the cliff just above where they crouched, but he had not seen them. The kudu turned his head and stared back in the direction from which he had come. The sunlight glinted in his nearest eye, and the set of his head and the alert, tense stance made it clear that something had disturbed him. For a long moment he stood poised like that, and then, still without being aware of the presence of Nicholas and Rayan, he snorted and abruptly leapt away in full flight. He vanished from their sight behind the ridge, and the sound of his run dwindled into silence. Something scared the living daylights out of him. "What?" inquired Rayan. "It could have been anything. A leopard, perhaps," he replied, and he hesitated as he looked down the slope. The caravan of mules and monks had set off already and were following the trail up along the river bank. "What should we do?" Royan asked. "We should reconnoitre the ground ahead. That is, if we had time, which we haven't." The caravan was pulling away swiftly. Unless they went down immediately, they would be left behind alone, unarmed. He had nothing concrete to act upon. And yet he had to make an immediate decision. "Come on." He took her hand again, and they slid and scrambled down the slope. Once they reached the trail, they had to break into a run to catch up with the tail of the caravan. Now that they were again part of the column, Nicholas could turn his attention to searching the skyline above them more thoroughly. The cliffs loomed over them, blocking out half the sky. The river on their left hand washed out any other sounds with its noisy, burbling current. Nicholas was not really alarmed. He prided himself on being able to sense trouble in advance, a sixth sense that had saved his life more than once before. He thought of it as his early warning system, but now it was sending no messages. There were any number of possible explanations for the reflection he had picked up from the crest of the cliff and for the behaviour of the bull kudu. However, he was still a little on edge, and he was giving the high ground above them all his attention. He saw a speck flick over the top of the cliff, twisting and falling. A dead leaf on the warm, wayward breeze. It was too small and insignificant to be of any danger. But nevertheless, he followed the movement with his eye, his interest idle. The brown leaf spiraled and looped and finally touched lightly against his cheek. He lifted his hand as a reflex and caught it. He rubbed the brown scrap between his fingers, expecting it to crackle and crumble. Instead, it was soft and supple, with a fine, almost greasy texture. He opened his hand and studied it more closely. It was no leaf, he saw at once, but a torn scrap of greased paper, brown and translucent. Suddenly, all his early warning bells jangled. It was not just the incongruity of manufactured paper suddenly materializing in this remote setting. He recognized the quality and texture of that particular type of paper. He lifted it to his nose and sniffed it. The sharp nitrous odor prickled the back of his throat. "Jelly!" he exclaimed aloud. He knew the smell instantly. Blasting gelignite was seldom employed for military purposes in this age of semtex and plastic explosives, but was still widely used in the mining industry and in mineral exploration. Usually the sticks of nitrogelatin in a wood pulp and sodium nitrate base was wrapped in that distinctive brown grease paper. Before the detonator was placed in the head of the stick, it was common practice to tear off the corner of the paper wrapper to expose the treacle-brown explosive beneath. He had used it often enough in the old days never to forget the odour of it. His mind was racing now. If somebody was expecting them and had mined the cliff with gelignite, then the reflection he had picked up could have been from the coils of copper wiring strung between the explosive in the rock. Or it could have been from some other item of equipment. If that was so, then the operator might even at this moment be lying concealed up there, ready to press the plunger on the circuit box. The kudu bull might have been fleeing from the concealed human presence. "Ali!" he bellowed down to the head of the caravan. "Stop them! Turn them back!" He started to run forward towards the head of the caravan. But in his heart he knew it was already too late. If there was somebody up there on the cliff, he was watching every move that Nicholas made. Nicholas could never hope to reach the head of the column and turn the mules around on the narrow trail and get them back to safety before... He came up short and looked back at Royan. Her safety was his main concern. He turned and ran back to grab her. "Come on, we have to get off the track." "What is it, Nicky? What are you doing?" She was resisting him, pulling back against his grip on her arm. "I'll explain later," he snapped at her brusquely. "Just trust me now." He dragged her a couple of paces before she gave in and began to run with him, back in the direction from which they had come. They had not covered 50 yards before the cliff face blew. A vast disruption of air swept over them, with a force that made them stagger. It clapped painfully in their skulls and threatened to implode the delicate membranes of their eardrums. Then the main force of the blast swept over them, not a single blast, but a long rolling detonation like thunder breaking directly overhead. It stunned and battered them so that they reeled into each other and lost the direction of their flight. Nicholas seized her in a steadying embrace and looked back. He saw a series of explosions leap from the crest of the cliff, tall, dancing fountains of dirt and dust and rubble, pirouetting one after the other, in strict choreography, like a chorus line of hellish ballerinas. Even in the terror of the moment, he could appreciate the expertise with which the gelignite had been laid. This was a master bomber at work. The leaping columns of rubble subsided upon themselves, leaving the fine, tawny mist of dust drifting and spiralling against the clear blue of the sky, and for a moment longer it seemed that the destruction was complete. Then the silhouette of the cliff began to alter. Slowly at first, the wall of rock started to lean outwards. He saw great cracks appear in the face, opening like leering mouths. Sheets of rock collapsed and in slow motion slithered down upon themselves like the silken skirts of a curtsying giantess. The rock groaned and crackled and rumbled as the entire cliff began to fall into the river far below. Nicholas was mesmerised by the awful sight, and his brain seemed to have been numbed by the explosion. It took a huge effort to force himself to think and to act. He saw that the centre of the explosion had occurred further down the trail, near the head of the mule caravan. Tumri was up there, beside Ali. He and Royan were at the tail of the caravan. The bomber up on the cliff had obviously been waiting for them to come directly into the epicentre of his explosive trap, but had been forced to trigger it when he saw them running back down the trail and realised that they had been alerted and were about to escape. Yet they were not clear. They were about to catch the peripheral force of the landslide that was developing above them. Still holding Royan, Nicholas stared up the falling cliff face and made a desperate calculation. He watched in petrified fascination as the vast tide of falling rock swept over the trail ahead of him, picking up men and mules, carrying them with it over the edge and down into the riverbed. It swallowed them, lapping them up like the tongue of some fearsome monster, and chewing them to pulp with razor fangs of red rock. Even above the rumbling roar of the rock tide, he heard the terrified screams of men and animals as they were ploughed under. The wave of destruction spread towards where he and Royan stood upon the trail. If they had been directly under the explosion, they would have stood as little chance as those others. But as it ran down the cliff, its destructive momentum was dissipating. On the other hand, Nicholas realized that there was no hope that they would be able to outrun it, and what was about to fall upon them would still be devastating. And there was no time to explain to Ryan what they had to do. He had only seconds left in which to act. Sweeping her up in his arms, he leapt over the bank towards the river. He lost his footing almost immediately, and they went down together, rolling, end over end. About 30 feet down there was a spur of rock the size of a house. As they came up against the upper side of it, it broke their fall. They were half stunned, but Nicholas dragged Royan to her feet and guided her into the lee of the rock wall. There was a cutback here, and they crept into it and crouched flat. Pressing themselves hard against the wall, they both held their breath as the first chunk of cliff came bounding and bouncing down towards them like a gigantic rubber ball, picking up speed with gravity until it smashed into their shelter with a force that made the solid rock against which they were cringing vibrate and resound like a cathedral bell, and the hurtling missile leapt high over their heads, spinning massively in flight before it dropped into the river. It raised a tidal wave from the surface that broke like storm surf on both banks. This was merely the forerunner of the maelstrom that now poured over them. It seemed that half the mountain was falling upon them. As each slab crashed into their shelter, daggers and splinters burst from its leading edges, filling the air they breathed with fine white dust and the sulphurous stink of sparking flint. This immense cascade flew over their heads, or piled up in front of their shelter, and loose chips and pebbles rained down upon them. Nicholas crawled over the top of Royan and covered her with his body. A stone struck the side of his head, a glancing blow that made his ears ring, but he gritted his teeth and fought the impulse to lift his head and look up. He felt something warm and ticklish snaking through the short hairs behind his right ear. It crept down his cheek like a living thing, and it was only when it reached the corner of his mouth and he tasted the metallic salt that he realized it was a trickle of blood. The fine talcum dust powdered them and irritated their throats so that they coughed and choked in the uproar. The dust seeped into their eyes, and they were forced to clench their lids and keep them tightly shut. One mass of rock, the size of a wagon, sprang high in the air and then fell back close beside where they lay. The impact made the earth jump so violently that Royan, with Nicholas's weight on top of her, was struck in the belly and diaphragm with a force that drove the wind from her lungs, and she thought that her ribs had been crushed.